Today, though, we're going to start a new dialogue, and I'm just going to say right now, I don't really have a strong sense of exactly where we're going yet. Actually, I think we could say that about every new series that we do. So that's really always true. But this time, as more than any, I'm going to ask for you guys to help kind of guide and direct what we're going to talk about over the next several weeks. We're going to begin today, and I'll tell you what we're going to be talking about. But I'm looking for you to kind of give me some ideas. Like, hey, let's talk about this. So this is what it is. Let me give you the idea what we'll be doing. You guys know the last several weeks, I didn't talk last couple weeks. Last week we had 1-100. It was awesome. We'll talk about that more in a minute. Before that, I think it was open mic or something. Sydney was here, yeah. So it's been a while. And during those off weeks, I had an opportunity to do some of the things that I don't normally have time to do normally when I'm preparing a message every week. And so I had a lot of meetings to catch up with people. And it's one of the things as part of pastoring, for spiritual direction. And I love it. I enjoy talking to people about their spiritual journey and the questions that they're wrestling with and the things that God's doing in their life. And so I had all these meetings, but I realized that maybe the most difficult part of pastoring is learning how to say things that people need to hear but don't want to hear, but say it in a way that they're okay with it. You know what I mean? Like, I just realized that I was having all these meetings, and I do this a lot, and it's been kind of a constant theme throughout ministry, is that, you have to have a lot of tact and diplomacy. You know, you have to learn. You've been in conversations like this. You know, you had something that you needed to say to somebody, but the whole time you're thinking, if I just say this, they're going to get pissed. And so how do I say this in a way that they'll listen to it? You know, I think it's maybe the most difficult part about spiritual development or maybe just about pastoring in general is that we live in a world where people seem to be very easily offended. Have you noticed this? And maybe it's not. Like, I was wondering, I've been asking people, like, is it really any different now? I don't know. But it seems like we live in a world where you really have to watch a lot because people kind of walk around a little bit. Like, we got like a lot of, you know, kind of fragile snowflakes of people, and you really want to be careful not to offend them. And like I said, I don't know if it's true. Maybe today we just have more people having more of a voice so they can express the things that frustrated them. Like, maybe people were always being offended and frustrated. It's just they never had a way to voice that concern. You know, I don't really know what it is. But I think most of us can agree that one of the difficult things about being in our world today is that you've kind of got to constantly be watching to make sure you don't step over the line here and step over the line there. And I think that's a good thing. But what I was realizing is when I was having all these meetings and I'm searching just for the right words to say the right thing to the right person, it just kind of dawned on me that Jesus, he seemed to have this really, is beautiful actually, a really beautiful way of saying things that would make people kind of squirm a little bit. You know what I mean? Like, if you've ever been reading the Bible, you've been reading some of Jesus, and you've encountered something that he said, and do you ever have those things where you're like, seriously, like, did you seriously just say that? Because Jesus seemed to have this really beautiful way to say things that would make people kind of cringe a little bit. And he was like an equal opportunity offender. You know, rich people, poor people, educated, uneducated, people with power, people without. Like, it seemed like Jesus had this ability to say things that would kind of make people go, just squirm a little bit. But he did it in a good way. That's what I found so amazing is Jesus would say these hard truths, and he would say it in a way that people loved him for. Like, no matter what situation, whether he was encountering a religious person or an unreligious person, Jesus had this very beautiful humility about his words and the way he would speak. He was loving, but yet at the same time, he was direct and clear. Let me give you just one example. This is Jesus when he's talking to his disciples in John chapter 6, verse number 61. Jesus said, aware that his disciples were grumbling about this. So it's about what Jesus had just been talking about. So the disciples were grumbling about this. Jesus said to them, does this offend you? So Jesus, I think, was aware, right? He was aware that there were times when his words would cut people a little bit. It would destabilize them and push them a little bit off of balance and make them kind of go, whoa, wait a minute. But yet he would always do this in this very beautiful way. And I think that this is the reason why. Listen to what he says. He says, does this offend you? Then verse 62. Then what if you see the Son of Man ascend to where he was before? And then he says this, the Spirit gives life. The flesh counts for nothing. In other words, I think Jesus had this revelation that our feelings, our flesh, that really is secondary to the work that the Spirit is doing to bring life into our soul. And then he finishes with these words. He says, the words I have spoken to you, they are full of the Spirit and life. I think Jesus continued to walk with this beautiful humility, but yet he was very direct, and he would speak right to a person's issue, and I think he did so out of this recognition that his words carried life, that there was something that these that the world needed to hear, that that person he was meeting with desperately needed to hear to bring life to their soul. And so he would speak with this, he just would be just like, hey, does this offend you that I'm saying this? Now, for us, though, I think we sometimes make a mistake. I think we will read Jesus, and we'll see how direct he is and how he would just go right at an issue. And I think sometimes we confuse honesty with just being a jerk. You ever known someone like that? You know, I think sometimes we think this is just a license that we can just be a complete butthead to whoever we want because we're right. You know, Jesus did it. But yet when you read the words of Jesus, he was always had this beautiful humility and compassion about what he said. Jesus never set out to be provocative. And if you've known people like that, they just seem like they're putting something on Facebook just to see if they can get a rise out of people, you know? Or maybe you've met the person that tries to be a little bit more extreme than you or a little bit more extreme, you know? But Jesus seemed like he was never out just to be provocative. He was always gracious and humble. He was bold without ever being brash. He was direct and he was clear. And so I think if the Son of God communicated in such a way that there was this humble, loving spirit about him, how much more must we, right? So I think when we're even, I just want to say at the outset here, to preface our entire conversation over the next several weeks, that this is not an excuse to give us the reason or give us an excuse to go out to the world and just be jerks about things, right? But I think Jesus also recognized that his words carried life. And he recognized that there were times where there were truths that we needed to hear, even if we wanted to hear them or not. Have you ever had that? Have you ever had the thing where you needed to hear something? Somebody loved you enough to tell you the truth, even when you didn't really want to hear the truth? And Jesus recognized there were times when we needed to hear these words of life, even at the risk that it may possibly offend us. And so here's what I want to do over the next several weeks. I want to look at some of the things that Jesus said that kind of would make his hearers squirm a little bit. I want to dive into some of these difficult topics, the things that Jesus would say and people around him would be like, oh, seriously, did you say that? And I want to ask some difficult questions about them. Like, I want to ask ourselves, first, why did he say that? Right? Why? What was the point? What was he trying to get at? And then I want to ask, well, what does that mean? What does these words mean for us? And then most importantly, how are we going to respond? How do we respond? Because the temptation for all of us every week, I'm guessing, or for most of us, is going to be to respond in that offense, to respond in some sort of like, you build a wall and you get a little frustrated and you're like, well, I can't believe they're talking about that. And he's, you know, can't believe Ryan would pull this topic up. And really, that's what I want to talk about. I want to take these next couple of weeks and talk about some of the things that I've sat back at home and thought, I don't know if I've got enough tact, really, to tackle this subject. I don't know if I've got the diplomacy skills to talk about this, but yet Jesus would talk about these very, sometimes, offensive truths. Now, an assumption that I'm going to make, as we set into this, and we'll make this assumption about each other, and I want you to make this assumption even about the people sitting around you when we do this, is I want to make the assumption that we all want to know the truth. Right? We're going to assume as we go into it that what we all really want is we want the truth. That is, of course, not always true, right? Sometimes we prefer to lie to ourselves. Sometimes we prefer to live in the self-delusion. Sometimes we've built this little world for ourselves based upon these falsehoods. We don't want to know. We don't know they're false, and the truth is we don't want to know they're false because that's going to challenge everything that we think the world is about. It's going to challenge some of the presuppositional foundations on which we have built our worldview. But so I know it's honest. It's actually not true that we always want to know the truth, but I'm going to assume that you do, because here's what I believe. I believe that underneath that instinctual proclivity towards comfort and instinctual kind of desire for people to not rock the boat, I believe that down underneath that is something else. I think underneath our desire to keep things safe and to keep things PC, I think underneath that is this desire to be right. And I don't mean like I'm right and you're wrong right. I mean maybe we could use the word righteous. That I think that there's a desire that we would all find our souls on the right side of truth. There's a desire for inside of us that we want to be, we want to have our soul to be resonating with beauty in a way that could be said that we were true, that we were righteous. Maybe I think that there's this drive that's underneath our desire to protect our worldview, and so whatever opinions or whatever beliefs or whatever worldview you currently hold, whatever it is that you think you hold now, I believe that you hold those positions because you believe they're right. Because deep inside, we want to be right. None of us holds an opinion or holds a particular view on a subject that we know to be false intentionally. Like, we, if whatever it is that you believe strongly, you might, I'm voting for Hillary, I'm voting for Trump, or all Hillary people are idiots, or all Trump fans are bigots, or what. Like, we have these viewpoints, right? We have these things, and we have these viewpoints, right or wrong, but we believe them to be right. In our mindset, in our we hold them because we, whether they are right or not, we believe that they are. And so here's the thing. Here's what I want us to recognize. If we are believing some truths and we believe that they're right and they're not, then anytime we encounter the truth's going to seem false to us. See, if you believe a lie long enough, the lie starts looking like the truth, and then the truth will begin to look like a lie. So here's what I want to prepare you for over these next several weeks, is there might be some times where the truth is going to confront you, but your confrontation with the truth, your encounter with the truth may at first be painful. It may offend you. It may push you back. You may feel yourself recoiling a bit, and that's okay. Really, honestly, that's okay, because that is our instinctual, natural kind of drive to protect ourselves. We're trying to avoid the pain of admitting that we're wrong. And here's what we have to remember, that for any of us to admit that we have been wrong is excruciatingly painful, right? And so you're going to encounter some truths over these next several weeks, and it may be painful. You may immediately recoil and say, that can't be right. No, I don't agree with that. I don't believe that. But here's the thing. It's okay. It's okay. It might go against something that's deep inside of you, and it may offend you, and that may be nothing more than your instinctual response towards self-preservation. It might just, that feeling that you think that you're feeling because you're, no, I'm right, and then you're wrong, that it might actually just be your kind of in your soul, your person's, your heart's desire to protect itself and not have to admit that it's wrong. And here's the, so we're going to wrestle with some truths. And here's the thing, I might present something, maybe I'm wrong. You know, I'm just going to do the best that I can do to present some things that I think is truth. And we're going to wrestle through these things together, and we'll talk about them. And then at the end, we'll have an open mic, and we can all kind of voice our thoughts and opinions. So here's what I want you to do. If you found something, or if you've wrestled with something that you found that Jesus taught, or something in the Bible, and you thought, man, That's offensive, or that was hard. That's hard to deal with. Maybe shoot me a text, send me an email, and I'll study maybe with some things we can work through, and we could talk about them together. So here's the thing. Here's what I want you to do as we go through this. I want you to recognize it's going to be difficult, and I think this is why Jesus, when he was traveling through Jerusalem or in the countryside, he could continually say, "He who has ears, let him hear." I think what he was saying is this: there are some people out there, and you've closed yourself off. You know, you've got physical ears, but your emotional ears, your soul is closed. And so I think Jesus would just say today, he who has ears to hear, let him hear. So be open. Just have your soul be responsive and ready to receive truth and ready to wrestle. And maybe even today, be bold enough. I'm searching for the right word. Maybe brave enough to say, maybe I'm wrong. And let's wrestle with these truths together. Be open. Let's be honest as we wrestle with some of the truths that might make us squirm. So, first one today, Matthew chapter 6, verse 24. We're going to jump in. That was just kind of the introduction to let us know where we're going. I could use your help. So if you have something, let me know. But Matthew 6, 24, if you have a Bible, and we'll jump in. This is the story of the rich young ruler. We've talked about it several times, and we're not going to go through the whole story, but I just want to talk about what Jesus said right after this encounter. The very, very end. So verse number 24, Jesus says, yes, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God. And I think when we read that, we're like, whew, thank God Jesus said it's hard for a rich person to enter, not us, right? Like, I think that's how we read it. We're like, oh, whew, Jesus is talking about rich people. That's somebody else. That's not me. And we kind of give ourselves a break about this. That's how we kind of interpret this statement. And I think that sometimes I wonder about that. Because it's amazing to me, I do this all the time. Like, I am so guilty of this. I hear us kind of talk on Thursday nights or guys night, or sitting at Starbucks. We always talk about like how bad we have it. Oh yeah, man, or like when I was a kid, man, it was so rough. You know, it was just so, and you hear those stories, and I'm thinking, sometimes you try to pull back a little bit and remind ourselves that we're living in the most affluent culture the world has ever seen. Right now, like this is it. There has never been a people group as a whole that has more wealth, more power, more ability, more privilege than us sitting here right in this room right now. And I sometimes think it's maybe a little offensive that we sit around and at times talk about the fact that we're the poor people. Because we look at these scriptures where Jesus talked about riches, and it's constantly we think he's talking about somebody else. And I think I understand why we do that. Because I think for most of us, we always define rich through comparison to others. It was interesting, the Gallup, the polling organization, they did a poll, and they called people throughout the country in all different socioeconomic, sectors, and they asked them to give them their definition of rich. And what they found out is that everyone has a pretty similar definition of what rich is. But what was interesting is that everyone defines rich as people who have approximately twice as much income as they did, which I think was really interesting. If they called someone with a household income of about $20,000, asked them to define rich, they'd define it about 40. Call the person at 40, well, no, rich is not me at 40. Rich is the people with 80 or people with 160 or whatever. We all define rich as someone who just has more than me. Like, so what that means is rich then, the concept of rich in our minds, it's like a moving target. And that could create a problem, because here's the thing, it would be very easy for us in this room to be rich and never feel it, never feel rich. Now, what a waste is that? Imagine being a part of the culture that people for history past have only dreamed of having the type of power and influence that we have, and yet we don't even feel it and be able to enjoy it because we don't even know that we are it. And here's an even bigger danger. Not only could we be rich and not feel it, we might even be rich and not even know it. And this is, of course, it presents a huge problem, because as we've said before, Jesus doesn't have a whole lot of good things to say about people who are rich. He just doesn't. I am shocked at how little the church talks about this. I'm shocked that we don't, because it's so clear in Scripture, but I do understand why. You know, I've said to you guys before, it's always been hard for me to talk about finances in church, so I didn't do it for the first 5 years of dialogue at all. Never one time even brought the subject up. And so I understand it, but frankly, it is kind of shocking how little the church talks about Jesus' stance on riches. Like, here's the thing. How many people in the world are unclear on where the church stands on, say, abortion? You know, if you look just at the average modern evangelical church, I think they make their stance pretty clear on the issue of abortion or on the issue of homosexuality. No one's wondering where the church stands. We're pretty loud and clear on what most churches believe in that category, right? But when it comes to riches, you don't hear a word. Yet Jesus makes this very clear. Here's what he says. It is easier for a camel. Now, I want you guys to get a mental picture, all right? I know some of you guys are not a real vivid, vivid imagination. I want you to get a picture of this. It is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle. Think about that. Get a picture of that, because I don't know, you might eventually get the camel through, let's say it's like a big sewing needle, all right? Like, or big, like, you know, I don't know. It's a big, you might eventually get a camel through there, but I'm going to guess on the other side, you don't have a camel anymore. You probably got like a camel juice or something. You know what I mean? It's going to look like that Play-Doh thing that we all had where you squish the Play-Doh and make Play-Doh spaghetti. That's what it's going to look. You're going to have camel spaghetti. At the end of, that's the image that I'm having in my brain right now. So that's how warped my brain is. And so Jesus was trying, he wasn't trying to say it was difficult. You know what he's trying to say? He's trying to say it's impossible. It is impossible for a rich person to enter or see the kingdom of heaven. Now, that's a truth that makes people squirm. It ought to, anyway. It ought to make people in this room right now feel, what is he trying to, I mean, that is shocking. And here's the thing. This is exactly the place where, like, theologians or Bible scholars kind of step in and they start trying to, like, massage the truth a little bit. And maybe some of you have heard this, because I read tons of things this last week in studying. People, and I've heard this before, and perhaps you have, Jesus wasn't talking about, like, an actual needle. He was talking about something else. And then they will tell you that there was a gate in the city of Jerusalem. It was a small gate. Have you heard this, Michael? It was a small gate, and this gate was called the Eye of the Needle. And so at night, when they would close the main gates, anyone that came in had to enter through this smaller gate, and a camel could only go through it if it would first unload all of its cargo and then get down on its knees. And so the message Jesus is trying to say is that a rich person has to humble themselves to come into the kingdom. Heaven, there's only one problem with this. No historian has any idea what they're talking about. I looked all week, and there's not one single historical shred of evidence. I mean, I even wanted this to be the case, right? I wasn't trying to disprove it. I'm like, where is this gate? And no one knows. No one has ever heard of the Eye of the Needle. There's been no ruins uncovered. There's no maps. Nobody knows. And so it may be true. It would be cool if it were, but most likely it's not. And here's the thing anyway, the word in Greek for needle, this passage is recorded in different gospels. And some of the gospels, the word for needle means a sewing needle. And another gospel, I think it's Luke's gospel, it refers to a surgical needle. I mean, it's like pretty clear. Jesus was trying to make a point. He's not saying, hey, it's just really, really, really difficult. You got to humble yourselves. He's saying it's impossible. If you're rich, it's going to be impossible to get into the kingdom of heaven. Here's what I think Jesus was saying. I think Jesus was saying, listen, you've got to understand that there is a strong correlation. There is a strong connection between your spending and your spirituality. Like, you may not recognize this, and maybe you haven't felt it. You may not even really want to know the truth. But Jesus was willing to tell us the truth, and he says this. Here's the truth. There is a strong correlation between how you spend your money and the status of your soul. Well, why is this? Well, Paul picks up on the same theme, and he talks to his protege, a guy by the name of Timothy. So it's in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 17. Look what Paul tells Timothy in verse 17. He says, command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. So here's what Paul was saying. He says, listen, Timothy, you got to understand, there is a natural inclination that rich people are going to have. There's like a gravitational pull on rich people, and there's this natural kind of push where your sense of hope, your security, your hope to begin to migrate to money. Now, I don't think that's obvious on the surface, but he's using some wisdom. But let's unpack it a little bit. Paul says, listen, you need to warn the rich people because there's this natural tendency for rich people to begin to put their hope, their security, the thing that they feel like is bringing them through, the thing that they're putting their trust in, to begin to put that hope in money. See, that rich people tend to have the potential to reach the point where they see money as their source of safety and security. In other words, I think what Paul was saying is, listen, money can become sort of a god to you. Maybe you felt this, and maybe you'd never use those terms. I know I wouldn't have before until I started thinking about this week. But money can become a god because money then starts telling you what you can and can't do. Like, here's a perfect example. How many of you ever said, well, I know God says give, but my checkbook says don't give. I don't really have any money. And so which do I obey? I obey my checkbook. And so Paul says, warn the people, because money then can kind of become like a god. You'll begin to obey the money instead of obeying God. Or it's even like this. You've probably seen people that begin to derive a little bit of their security for their future from their 401k. You know, I just don't feel comfortable. I'm not really ready for retirement yet. And you've seen that stress as people near retirement. They start stressing out a little bit. And listen, is it wise to think about your future? Absolutely. But what can happen is we can begin to think that, man, if I have enough money, then I'll be okay. See, we begin to believe that our God who's going to provide for us, our God who's going to take care of us, is our retirement. You've seen people who they spend their life, their life's ambition, their life's purpose is all wrapped around what they do 9 to 5 to get that paycheck. So money can begin to provide a sense of meaning and purpose in this world. And so Paul says, command the people who are rich to be humble and not to begin to put their hope in the finances. But then he says this. He says in verse 18, command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. Paul says the antidote is not to not be rich. The antidote is to be generous. So he says, command them to give, because as you give, something transforms inside of your soul. And the antidote to this greed, the antidote to living as a way that money is in charge, the antidote to having money, your checkbook, or the lack of money being your God, is to be generous. It is the antidote to having your hope placed in this God of money. And here's what I found so amazing. This is why I want to talk about this. I feel like at Dialogue, we're doing that. I mean, how many of you guys, who was here last week? Well, I know John's back, everybody. I don't know if you've noticed, but so good to see John. But I know you weren't here last week because you've been getting better and getting healthy, and it's so awesome to see you up and about. But I think for the most of us, was last week not the most amazing thing? Like, it was just freaking, and we've talked about this a couple of times at Dialogue and in the last couple of years, and this is what I realized this last week. It's like, guys, I think it's working. We've been talking about being more generous, and we've been talking about giving, and I know that we're just a small church. I know our budget's not huge. I know we don't have a lot of resources, but we have made a commitment to be generous. And I'm telling you, it's the most beautiful thing that I've ever seen. All week long, I've been on this spiritual high. I've been like buzzing, and I want you to know, I am so proud to be a part of this church. Like, I've been bragging to people. Like, every time I turn around, I'm like, oh, did I tell you what we did last week at our church? And like, you know, like, I just like, ha, 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 our church is better than your church. And I'm not even trying to fight it. I'll be honest with you. Like, there's this little voice inside of me that says, well, that's just being prideful. And I'm like, shut up, voice. Because, you know, like, I don't care right now. Like, I feel like we're doing this. Last week, we did this thing called 1-100. We decided that we were going to take 1 week of our giving, and we were going to donate all of that to combat hunger in our community. And so we just challenged everyone to give what you would give in 1 week. And on September, whatever it was, I think it was the 3rd, 7th, 18th, I don't know, I don't even know what today is, let alone last week. I don't know who I'm trying to fool. But a week ago, 4th, thank you, we just took up this offering. Now, here's the thing. You guys may not know this, but our average 1 week giving is $800. I shared this a little for the few of you, but that's what we average, $800. That's when we pool our resources, we come together as a family, and we all throw in what we can, what we feel like we can give, and that's the money that we use each and every week. It's the money that we use to buy stuff for kids' church. It's the money we use to pay the bills, to pay the rent, to buy the insurance so we can run things, and so we can buy all the gear. You see, it pays my salary. It pays a little bit of money to Mike and to Amanda for doing the things that they do. So we take the $800, and we try our very hardest to invest that in the best and most responsible, wise ways that we can. But $800 is what an average week for us is. So we said, well, basically, I did this. I kind of opened my mouth, and later people look at me and like, you're an idiot. And I think I'm just kind of, it bounces off. I'm impervious to that anymore. I'm like, seriously, you got that's all you got. But I was talking, and I said in a thing, I was like, let's make a goal of $1,000. And that's when Amanda sent me a thing that said, our average giving is only 800. And I'm like, well, you know, but that was our goal. Our average giving was 800. Our goal for this week was 1,000. And have you heard the total yet? Here's how much we raised in 1 week. $1,660.50. That's awesome. Yeah, someone should like clap or something for that, because that is just freaking amazing. Yeah. You know, I don't know. What did I put? I didn't make that slide, I don't think. Did I? Maybe I did. It's not that. But clap at that. That number would even be awesome. $1,660.50. That's over twice what we normally bring in 1 week. I mean, literally, guys, that is, we just said do this in 1 week, and that's over twice of what. Yeah, I probably typed it wrong on the thing, Marissa. I'm sorry. That's my bad.
No, you did it on purpose.
I did.
The expectation is low.
Right. And then I could say, even better, guys. No. And here's the thing. If you participated in this, or actually, even if you didn't participate in this, I want you guys to know how proud I am of who we are as a church. And I want to be very, very clear on that. Like, I'm super proud that we raised $1,650 or $60.50. I'm super thankful that person that was like, and 50 cents. You know what I mean? I love that, because here's the thing. We all participated. That might have been one of the kids. I don't know. You know, it might have been someone who's like, I think this is all I can do. And they gave what they could give. And together we could do something beautiful, because we all just did what we could. And some of you did even more than you probably thought you could do. And so here's what I want you to know. Whether you participated or whether you couldn't, I am super proud not only of what we did, but I am proud of who we are. Who we're becoming. I'm proud that we are a church that is getting what it means to be generous. And so I want to just give you 5 things quickly. What are we on? Have I talked too long? Oh, crap. How did I possibly do this? Well, I know, but then you guys will believe me. I'll get like 75 emails, and I'm like, there was only 30 people here. It's like, some of you sent me 3 emails telling me how long we went last week. Let me give you quickly 5 things that I think that we're doing, and the reason why I'm so proud of who we're becoming. Because number one, as I just said, generosity changes us. When we give, it breaks the power of greed. inside of us. We're living in a culture that tells us that we're going to find our safety and our security from our finances, from our wealth, from spending. And every time you give, you break that. You say, when you give, you tell your soul that I'm connected to a life source that is so much deeper and so much more beautiful. And I think our soul comes alive when we're generous. So giving changes. The second thing is this. Just, if you want to take notes, you can write them down. You can ask me later. Giving changes is the first reason. Second thing is this. Generosity requires need, not abundance. This is something that I've learned. And when I learned, I was like, man, I've got to tell you guys. I think a lot of the times we think that because we're a little church, we can't do much. Guys, I can hear you talking. If you would quiet it down a little bit, that would help me focus. I think sometimes we think that because we're such a little church, we can't do much. And sometimes we think because I don't have a lot in my checkbook, I can't give much, right? So a lot of times I think we can't be generous because we have such a large need ourselves. But here's the thing. We raised $1,600 and that is freaking amazing. But I'm going to be honest with you. Friday, I went down to the BMW Championship, a golf tournament in Carmel. I drove by a house that on the front of the house, on the front, I could even see the side, there were 6 garage doors just on the front of the house. So that's what I would call rich. You know, not me, it must be them. But then I drove by some churches in this area. And these churches are beautiful. And listen, I'm not downing that. There were some churches that were just absolutely jaw-dropping, right? But here's my point. We gave $1,600. It was beautiful. But if one of those churches decided that they were going to take one Sunday and ask their 10,000 members to give what they could give, if they raised $1,600, and they gave it, I'm sure that what's the place called again? Second Harvest? I think Second Harvest would be like, dude, thank you. That's an amazing gift. But it just wouldn't be quite the same, right? Because think about how much money you felt like you were rich when you were a kid and you had $5 in your pocket, right? Like, and so in other words, in order to even be generous, it's got to come out of your need. You can't even really be generous unless you're giving out of your need. Remember the story of, I'm not going to read it, but remember Jesus and the widow's mite? And Jesus was standing and he's watching people as they put their offerings in. And he watches this widow and she comes and she puts in her 2 copper coins. And Jesus says, man, she gave more than everybody else because she gave not out of her abundance, but out of her need. So here's the thing. Right now is the time to be generous. Right now is the time to be giving. Right now is the time to, regardless of how much money you have, this is the time to be. I need to keep going. This was an important one. It's Matthew chapter 6, verse 24, if you want to turn there. Generosity is not going to happen unless you make it a priority. This is the thing. Generosity does not happen on accident. Here's what Jesus says. No one can serve 2 masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. So again, Jesus is like crystal clear here. You cannot serve both God and money. So here, what's he saying? Here's what he's saying. You're not going to just like drift into generosity. You're going to have to make a choice. Like you, it's just not going to happen one of these days because you're like, oh, what am I going to do with all this money? Gosh, I got so much freaking money in my wallet. I guess I'm just going to throw it and maybe some of it lands in an offering plate somewhere. Like, you know what I mean? It's just generosity is always going to be a choice that you make. And so it does not happen unless you make it a priority. So here's my tip. And this is something that I do. And this is one of those things that I've never had a good way of saying without saying with tact. So I'm just going to say it. If you want to be generous, this is what you got to do. Make it the first check that you write every month. Or if you get paid multiple times a month, every time you get paid, make that be the first check that you write. And it does a couple things. Number one, it says, God, I want to say thank you to you first. Before I pay my bills, before I buy groceries, before I do the first thing I'm going to do is say thank you to you. Also, it says, if you don't do that, that money's going to go, right? You'll find somewhere else to spend that money if you don't write that check. And so I'm just saying, listen, right? Make the first check that you write every month or every time you get paid to be your generosity. Now, listen, I'm not saying write it to Dialogue. Let me be really clear. There's a lot of worthwhile charities out there. There's a lot of places to invest your money that can do great things with your money. So don't interpret any of this as me saying you need to give to Dialogue. I give to Dialogue. I believe that we all should. I think that God calls us to give here. But I also know that the church traditionally has not always been super responsible with how we've spent your money. I'll just be honest. Sometimes I struggle with these. But I will say this. At Dialogue, we try our absolute best to be to spend your money in the ways that would bring the most glory to the kingdom. We try not to be frivolous with it, but even more, we have a meeting almost every month. It sometimes varies now, but when we meet, it's called our team meeting. We invite everyone to come, and we go over where every dollar is spent every month, and we just invite you. I'm looking around. I think you've all been here, so you know the drill. Just come. Like if you want to see where we're putting our dollars, come to these meetings. And if you think we're putting our dollars in places that are not wise investments, that's what the meeting's for. Tell us. Hey, stop spending so much reckless, frivolous money here, and let's invest it here. And that's what we do. But whether it's to dialogue or not, I'm just saying give. Give to God. Make it a priority each month. Next thing, what is this, 3 or 4? You don't know because you're not even writing them down, you jerks. The next one. This is an important one. Base your giving off of percentages, not dollars. And here's what I mean by that. Remember the story of the widow's mite? Jesus didn't say, well, she only gave 2 copper coins. He measured it by saying she gave 100%. Basing your giving off of dollars will just mess with your mind. Because it's going to do one of 2 things. Number one, you're going to look at the dollar amount and you're going to be like, look how awesome I am. You know, like you're going to look at that dollar amount and you're going to feel this arrogance or this pride about how much you gave. Or the flip side, you're going to look at it and you're going to say, man, I'm such a slug. I can only give $5. I can only put $20 in. And you're going to feel terrible. If you look at the dollar amount, it's either going to create pride or it's going to create shame. And neither one of those are healthy. Look, base your giving off of percentages. You ever notice how $20 when your kids seem like you were freaking rich? Like if you had $20 and you took me to Kmart, dude, I'd be like, I don't even know where to spend all this money. I'd be like giving some to my brothers. Or, okay, I probably wouldn't be doing that. But, you know, but like, you know what I mean? Like, you $20. But now, $20, you're like, I had $20 this morning. Where did it go? Did it like fall out of my, like, where did, you know, you don't even know where you spent it. If you look at the money, the dollar sign, it's going to mess you up. But here's the thing. Choose a percentage. Just pick a percent and be faithful to that percentage. Sit down together as a family and say, we can give this percent, 1%, 10%, 20%, whatever it is. And I know that some people will say, well, there's a certain percentage you have to give. Listen, you find, just pick a percent. 1%, 0.5% is better than 0%, you know? And so just pick a percent and then just stay faithful to that. And then as you grow and as God begins to bless you and as you see there's some fruit from your generosity or even more, here's what I think you're going to experience. Jesus says that you're going to begin to experience the kingdom of God. Remember? It says rich people, they can't enter that kingdom of God. But when you begin to be generous, you get to be a part of something like when we take our whole week of giving and buy food for people who are hungry. And you get to be a part of the kingdom of God happening. Heaven comes to earth and we're a part of it right now. And I think when you get a taste of that, like I think as you experience that, you can change the percent, but just pick a percentage and be faithful. Last one, I need to finish up. I didn't realize we were talking so long. Last thing is this, I just believe that generosity is a better way to live. And this is really the thing that's been changing me over the years. I've always, as you know, I've hated talking about finances because it has been the source of so much contention and so much hurt and so much scandal, and I just hate it. But here's what I've been realizing. This is why last week was so beautiful. What I realized is giving generosity is not just about funding the church. It's not just about generating dollars. Our generosity is not just about meeting the budget or about paying the bills. It's about changing our heart. It's about transforming who we are. We become better people when we're generous. I just believe generosity is a better way to live. And think about what Jesus said. I'm going to give you one more scripture. In Matthew 6:21, Jesus says, "For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." Where you put your money, that's where your heart's going to be. And so listen, when we're not generous with our money, it's not our money that we're withholding, it's our heart. When we're not generous with our community, when we're not giving with our time, when we're not being generous with our attitude and how we talk to people, it's not our money that we're withholding, it's our heart. Jesus says, your heart's gonna follow your money. And so when you invest that in the community, you're putting your heart out into this world, and that's what creates the beauty. And here's the thing, if you can tell you, I know we're all family here today, next week bring some more people, but today it's just family. But listen, we ought to be super pumped that churches are getting it. I mean, just imagine if all the churches would get this. Can you think of what would happen if all the churches in America, well, forget about all the churches in America, just imagine if all the churches in Muncie would take one Sunday and say, we're gonna give this to fight poverty. Think what we could do. Like, we have been ashamed of talking about giving, but listen, we ought to be super pumped that the more we talk about generosity and the more that we talk about giving, because the more generous we are with our finances, the more generous we are with our time, the more generous we are with our hearts, with our attitudes, with our love, the more we're going to see this world transformed by the power of the gospel. I mean, just imagine if the church, if Christians, if God followers would begin to be more generous with their compassion, if we'd be more generous with people in our disagreements, just imagine if we would be people who would be a little bit more generous on Facebook and not just repost that meme that offends everyone that disagrees with us. What if we could just be more generous? What if we could be the types of people that when people disagreed with us, we could just learn to wrap our arms around them and just call them brother or call them sister? You know, what if we could live in a world where respect began to replace racism, where peace began to replace violence? And Jesus says this only happens when your heart is transformed through generosity. See, here's what I believe. I believe that this is the dream that God is calling us to. I believe that what we experienced last week was just the tip of the iceberg. Like this is what Jesus imagined when he looked down at his church. And remember, he didn't say church. He didn't say corporation. You know, when Jesus looked at his church, he saw his bride. And he says, that's why I love you. It's because we can be a part of this generous giving spirit that transforms the world. So I believe it's going to take a generosity that goes far beyond our wallets and begins to change our hearts. I just believe that generosity is a better way to live. So I want to encourage you, whether you participated last week or not, we've got a lot more things coming. Next week is the rummage sale, right? That's what, talk about a chance to be generous. Go through your stuff this week. See what you can give. And you're going to be like me. I have like a little bit of hoarder syndrome, you know? And you'll be like, I don't know. I might use that. I haven't used it in 10 years, but I might use that, you know? Or you could be generous. You could use it as an opportunity to transform your heart and to create this world into a more beautiful place. So, I want to end with this prayer, and then we're going to come to celebrate this communion together. So, say this is a prayer of St. Ignatius of Loyola. This is a prayer that he prayed, and it was written down. It became a prayer that they would sometimes pray together. So I just want to read it to you, and then I'm going to ask if we could pray it together. So here's what he prayed. He said, Lord, teach me to be generous. Teach me to serve you as you deserve, to give and not count the cost, to fight and not heed the wounds, to toil and not seek for rest, to labor and not ask for reward, save that of knowing that I do your will. Can we pray that prayer together? Would you say it with me? Lord, teach me to be generous. Teach me to serve you as you deserve, to give and not to count the cost, to fight and not to heed the wounds, to toil and not to seek for rest, to labor and not to ask for reward, save that of knowing that I do your will.